Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja. I'm Nathan here with Nathan. Nathan, what's going on?
Not very much. We're still here.
We are. The election is over. We did our apocalyptic prediction. Well, our apocalyptic podcast. We didn't do any predictions or anything, but we did our apocalyptic podcast. Now that the elections are over, we're doing our post-apocalyptic podcast. So all the fun craziness that's gone on after the elections.
The beginning of the craziness. I think for me, it'll make for an interesting Thanksgiving with family members. It would have made for an interesting Thanksgiving with family members either way you slice it.
That is true.
That's where I think we can leave it.
Dude, but let's be real. That's why God invented liquor. To get us through the holidays.
Yeah, there you go. There's your spiritual moment for this podcast. It didn't come from me.
It came from the guy who does the theological podcast.
That's right. I'm just going to leave it at please be kind to each other on Twitter and Facebook. Please.
Nice. Well, we are talking about post-apocalyptic forms of entertainment. We did a couple books last time. I think we maybe did like one or two video games, and we did a few more movies. I got to tell you, I'm excited mostly because we are entering my wheelhouse of being able to talk about a lot of video games. A lot of video games are made for post-apocalypse, and I'm excited to really dive into those and talk about those. I know we've got more movies that we're going to be talking about, and you've actually got a few more books that we're going to bring up.
I do, because many more books are written about the post-apocalypse.
Yes.
Than the apocalypse. Or it may just be that I've read more books.
There you go.
Well, I thought last podcast was very interesting because we're essentially looking at the heart of what is frightening about the apocalypse. And we talked about how the sense of something being revealed is how it was used, obviously, in Scripture, where apocalypse and Revelation were sort of hand-in-hand. And that's sort of how the term apocalypse came to eventually be used hand-in-hand with the biblical end times. And then it just became a more general term for the end of the world. And of course, post-apocalyptic is you're clearly on the other side of that line.
Yes.
Or on the other side. And now you have what the world looks like. And it's a good opportunity, I think, for people to do some world building while still dealing with some of those fears. But it's, I think post-apocalyptic fiction is both, can be very depressing. I mean, it can be very dark and nihilistic. But I think just by these, in most cases, there are probably examples where this isn't the case. But I feel like even the darkest post-apocalyptic fiction may still have a ray of hope because at some level we survived.
Yes.
You know, there is some element that humanity is still moving along. What humanity looks like on the other side of that veil may not really be worth much living.
Yes.
I mean, the Mad Max world is not really all sunshine and kittens.
Yes.
But people are still around. There's still a world where heroes are trying to burrow to the surface and things like that. So I think, and in some cases, literally burrow to the surface.
Yes.
You know, I think of the City of Ember, where there's a whole community of people living under the ground and they're fearing that the lights are going to go off. So I'm ready to dig in if you are, Nathan. You want to start with one of yours?
Yeah. So the first one I'm gonna go ahead and give the nod and mention to is an oldie but a goodie, Halo. Halo does take place in a post-apocalyptic world. The alien horde, the Covenant, has invaded Earth. It is set years in the future. Earth has been basically, you know, destroyed to a point where it is not unrecognizable, but it is definitely changed. And so, you know, in light of that, great game. You know, going back, I will say this, I haven't kept up with the Halo series, mainly because I'm bitter at Microsoft. We can talk about that on another podcast, though. But, you know, for me, Halo 1 and 2, still great multiplayer games. Halo 1, I think, took the cake for, you know, great single player game. And then, you know, it was a great multiplayer game, but Halo 2 really stepped it up a notch or two or three in that multiplayer aspect. So, you know, for that post-apocalyptic video game, just going to throw Halo out there and shoot it over to you for our first book and or movie.
So, yeah, and Halo, I played Halo a little bit, and I guess I just never, because I never got into the games as much, I was never that aware of it being post-apocalyptic, you know, because a good bit of it seems to take place on other worlds and other planets. And so I think that's an interesting aspect of post-apocalyptic, though, when you have basically humanity abandoning planet Earth. And then I guess there comes a question, even though those stories are typically considered post-apocalyptic, they sometimes don't have that feel, mm-hmm. you know, because I think sometimes humanity is out doing something else somewhere right. else. And well, so you don't always, though Halo did have some of that feel, perhaps yeah. in the later games, but when you're on the planet, you know, yeah. it's kind of similar to the War of the Worlds in a sense where it's a war story first, and right. it's like apocalypse happening yeah. at the same time.
Yeah.
I have not played many video games. However, I have played, a few years ago, we bought a PlayStation that came with the game The Last of Us.
Yes.
And a friend of mine was just raving about what a good game this was. Not even what a good game it was, what a good piece of entertainment it was, because mm-hmm. he felt that it had a very good and interesting story. And I was really concerned about it being sort of the same old when it comes to sort of the post-apocalyptic slash zombies. It's not sure. exactly zombies, but this feeling of a couple of people pitted against sort of this the overwhelming tide of darkness, yeah. right? That kind of represents humanity, but not completely. And you have this almost father-daughter style relationship occurring in the middle of it. It's an excellent game. I've got most of the way through it. Mm-hmm. I've talked to a friend who kind of like filled in a lot of the details. But it's kind of an affecting game too. The storyline is this, probably one of the stronger stories I've seen in a video game, mm-hmm. and sort of emotional and poignant at the same time. And I think what's compelling about the post-apocalypse in a video game format is that you're able to sort of play through these scenarios.
Yes.
And particularly in a game like Last of Us, you get this sense of overwhelming loneliness, which I yes. think is probably, we didn't really talk about that much in the last episode because we talked about how apocalypse is sort of like, you can even have a personal apocalypse where your whole mm-hmm. life is torn out from under you. And if you're that crazed homeless guy wandering the streets, it doesn't matter that you may be surrounded by thousands of people because right. you're trapped in your own hell, for lack of a better term. And Last of Us, I'm sure several other games too, that really capture that sort of feeling of the world is just completely falling apart. And I've seen other games that have been very fast and intense, mm-hmm. And Last of Us can be, but it just has a real melancholy. There's moments where it plays as much like a eulogy for mm-hmm. losing everything.
Yeah.
Have you played it?
I have played bits and pieces of it. I have not played all yeah. the way through.
What did you think? I was impressed. I thought for an experience it was very interesting.
I enjoyed it. I think it was, I can think of his video character name, Nathan Drake. His real life name, the guy who does the voice, will come to me. But I believe he does the voice of the main, the father figure character.
Yeah, the guy from Uncharted, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, to me, he's always Uncharted 4 to me was a more compelling story. There was a lot more going on in there, depth to it. And so, you know, he has that potential to really bring out the character of this apocalypse world, in my opinion. And I like that about those two characters. I felt they did a good job playing off of one another.
It seems
that
it only increases, which I like, is that very rarely you play a video game. You play a video game, see what happens next, of course.
Right.
But this was one of the few cases where I felt like you're playing the game and you're playing the game largely to see how the characters continue to interact.
Yes.
So you're kind of just trying to unveil elements of the character, which I think is one of the interesting things about post-apocalyptic. It's really about testing what's left of humanity mm-hmm. to see where they stack up and how they're going to be.
Yes.
And I think that you see that all through the history of post-apocalyptic mm-hmm. stories. A lot of them have elements of war and things like that. So Last of Us, I really enjoyed. That would be my kind of pick if we're going to video games. I've played a few others, you know, Fallout and things like that.
Sure.
I haven't played every iteration of any right. of these games. But Last of Us stood out to me as a story that has stuck in my mind. When I think of post-apocalyptic stories, I think of those. It's not just running around shooting monsters.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, another really good one, this is more recently, Destiny. Which came out 2 years ago, I believe, fall 2 years ago. Fantastic game. It was done by Bungie, the people who created Halo. So has a similar feel to it in some respects. This actually takes place mostly on Earth. Is your starting point, and then you do branch out into other planets, but it's within our solar system, and Earth is always your home main base, so you're always coming back home, you're always coming back to Earth. But again, you see another alien invasion game where you see you know, the ravages of what these aliens have done to the planet. You're actually resurrected by your little machine ghost, And you play through as this character, as this guardian, and it just a great fun game. Again, a remnant of Halo in there, but different because this is all online play. So you're always interacting with people in this world. You can always be teaming up to go on missions together, and you can always find someone to do something with. So kind of like that Warcraft type feel, but in a first-person shooter.
Very cool. And I'm a little glad they haven't managed to make movies out of any of these so far. I know we've had like the fan fictions or things like that.
Destiny would, I would be excited for a movie about that. But it needs to be done right.
It needs to be not done like Warcraft. But I'll let that go. What's one thing you look for in a good post-apocalyptic story, regardless of medium?
I want to know the backstory of what happened. That's got to be in there somewhere.
Like why we are where we are.
Yeah, why we are where we are. What caused us? So, for instance, a lot of people are going to shoot me for this. I fully recognize that, but they don't have my number, so we're all good.
We're also not in the post-apocalypse yet, so you may not get shot.
The Walking Dead. There are, Fear the Walking Dead was supposed to come out and really kind of explain what happened with the Walking Dead, but this was a spinoff of the Walking Dead within the Walking Dead series. As far as I know, there was no cognitive explanation of what happened.
Well, see, the trick is who's going to explain Fear the Walking Dead? Yes, I think that that's probably fair to say that you haven't had an explicit reasoning yet for exactly how the zombie apocalypse has happened. I will say, it being a zombie apocalypse, we can kind of formulate a little bit. It's interesting you say that, though, because to me, I almost don't care how things happened as long as we have a clear vision of what has happened. I think a good example of that would maybe be the Mad Max films, where we aren't, if we watch all the Mad Max movies, we can get a very basic picture of how society falls apart. And that it's sort of happening on a both financial and ecological level. And we know that there have been some wars and there's been feuds and there are those helpful little stories that tell us. But the world of each Mad Max movie seems a little bit different. And in one, we kind of suggest, well, it's the bomb happens. And in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, they sort of attribute to the apocalypse, as they call it. And Mad Max Fury Road almost takes place in a world that's almost completely different yet from those. So each Mad Max movie seems to come from the same idea that there's been some sort of human fallout. That humanity has caused the breakdown. And now we're all back in a medieval sort of system, but with some of the very crude vestiges of our technology left. Very, very crude in most cases. So to me, the Mad Max films are not in any way lowered because they don't fully explain their apocalyptic background, although I think it's safe to say they give you enough details that you could sort of come to how this happened. So the Mad Max movies maybe not be the best example because I think they give you enough to fill in the picture. But I get what you're saying, like with Walking Dead and some of these stories where we've got the world falling apart. The question becomes, how much do we need? And I think it's down to how well you build the world once you have destroyed it, in a sense. It's in terms of like on screen. I will say this in credit of The Walking Dead. I think it's been up and down in terms of its quality from season to season, but it's built a pretty strong cast of characters and it's brought an interesting viewpoint of people struggling with their basic human nature and their need to still be in some way idealistic. Like they still want to hold on to vestiges of, I still want to be a good moral person, or I want to be a successful father, or you know, the relationships still matter. It still matters that some of these characters decide not to kill, even in face of all the darkness they find. So to me, the Walking Dead world works because it's almost not about the zombies, and therefore if it's not really about the zombies, it doesn't matter as much how the zombies got here. The flip side of that, though, is when you have a world that's so vaguely explained that you can't understand it except to know why it's here.
And I think that's a fair statement. I'm always the type of person, though, that wants to see, I like to see things coming. You know, I like to plan out and kind of see what's on the horizon and say, okay, you know, if this happens, this could happen, you know. So I like those dots to be connected.
You're more apocalypse and post-apocalyptic. Yes. Okay.
Yes. I want to see, you know, the aliens coming in and, you know, blow up the mothership. You know, I want to see the, you know, see the virus starting and find the cure for it, you know. Not that I'm going to do that, you know, because...
You like to see a little bit of hope. Yes. You don't want it to feel like it's all for nothing.
Yes, exactly.
And I get that. And I think what is, the thing that most good post-apocalyptic stories have to have is a story where the stakes keep you invested, even though that basic goal of save the human race may be kind of off the table, mm-hmm. at least at a high level. And I think Walking Dead is about how do we save our humanity. And I think that's true of a lot of good...
Yeah.
Fiction, even my all-time favorite movies, might as well talk about it now, is The Road Warrior, the mm-hmm. George Miller second installment of the Mad Max movies. I think it stands alone very well, and it plays a lot like a Western,
yeah.
like a sort of almost Sergio Leone, Man with No Name sort of story, where you have Max come into the story. He has a whole movie that preceded him, but it's almost unnecessary mm-hmm. to know. In fact, when I had always seen The Road Warrior, when I caught up with Mad Max, I was a little disappointed. I mean,
right.
you get flashes of what happens to him. When I watched the movie that came before, it's like, oh, he hadn't quite hit his mythic stride. So in The Road Warrior, he shows up into this world that is being governed over battles for fuel. Everyone's kind of fighting a meager battle, but now it's all reduced to tribalism and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember watching that movie, and it was basically a very visceral experience, although... The story is really down to, is Max going to be able to regain enough of his humanity to be of a help to the people who need him?
Mm.
And I think if you can make that story click, then you're not concerned about, was the world going to make it? You want to know, is Max going to make this change? And I
sure.
think that's good. In some ways, post-apocalyptic stories can be so sparse that they force you to really be about character,
mm-hmm.
to really be about what's going to happen. And I think maybe the best stories are about... The characters are character driven. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any of the Mad Max movies, Nathan?
It's been years. I remember Beyond the Thunderdome was one of my favorites when I was younger.
It's pretty 80s-tastic.
Yes, but even that, I mean, I think the last time I saw that was, you know, close to 25 years ago. It's been a while.
Beyond Thunderdome was interesting because it ramped down the violence, because Road Warrior was mm-hmm. 1982, was a pretty brutal picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then Beyond Thunderdome kind of pulled it back into the PG-13 arena, but it also got kind of crazy, kind of really
right.
weird. I love
yes.
the thing about Thunderdome that I thought was so neat. And so to answer my own question, what do I want to see in a post-apocalyptic world? I want to see the creator of this world really deal with how did people find a way to
mm-hmm.
make it. To me, it's not enough to see a couple of people wandering around. I need to understand a little bit more about the society that's popped up in its place. Even
mm-hmm.
if that society is still struggling, I want to see why. Like,
sure.
how did you survive? And one of the cool things about Thunderdome, even though it's not, a lot of people don't think it's one of the better Mad Max movies, I really enjoy it because it does sort of give you these visions of things that you maybe haven't seen before. Like the barter town, when he gets into it, turns out to be run by Aunt Entity, who is like, you know, she's Tina Turner.
Right.
And
right.
she's got the crazy wig.
Yes.
And she's very... What happens is you eventually realize that most of that, even though Bartertown is run by the figurehead of Aunt Entity under the ground, Master Blaster,
mm-hmm.
The little guy who rides on the big guy's shoulders,
right.
is running the town through pig methane.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole town is run on pig farts. And and they've got this giant, like, vat of pigs under this entire city. Stuff like that to me was cool. Or when Max goes into the desert and he's sort of exiled and he finds his way to this small community of children that are just telling the myths of how the world ended, like, over and
yes.
over again. And they
yep.
built a mythology around this downed pilot and his body that they found remains there.
Yep.
Stuff like that to me is interesting because it taps into the question of, what have you done in the wake of it? In Bartertown, you could see it, this fantastic sort of little shanty town that they built out of pieces and recognizable
mm-hmm.
pieces. Mad Max Fury Road was a movie I absolutely loved.
Mm-hmm.
In a much crazier way, does the same thing. It almost feels like a fairy tale, but you get
right.
this sense of what these characters have done and what's happened with them.
Sure.
Even though it's sometimes a very dark, sinister world, it's a very captivating world because we're seeing a lot of imagination put into it.
Right.
And I think that's what's interesting is what's the level of the imagination that's gone into making yeah. making the world come to life.
Yeah. No, and I agree. It's for that reason that I found some movies that really, you know, weren't blockbuster hits. You know, many people didn't like them. I enjoyed them for the potential that they had in the world that they ended up building. I'll throw my cards out on the table. Two Kevin Costner movies that I liked. one was The Postman, and then the other one was Waterworld. And I did enjoy both of those movies. Are these two movies Shakespeare in the Park? No. But for me, The Postman was, I think that did a good job at building that world of, you know, what happened to Earth. You know, it's definitely in the future. Something has happened to cause this faction of hooligans to rise up and come in and, you know, start.
It was a civil war. It was a civil war with a loudmouth and a bunch of middle America states join him and they kind of take everything over. I don't know how else to say it. That was the plot of The Postman. I just remember the line, you know, do you remember Tang? We used to have Tang. The Postman also, I think, had an interesting sequence where at some point I think he goes and finds that Tom Petty's become the mayor of a city built around the dam.
Yes.
And it also at one point when he's taken hostage by the group, the Holists the Halists that followed Nathan Hale or this guy who had taken over, when he gets to their camp, they're just watching on a loop The Sound of Music and Universal Soldier back to back. So if you ever question what they watch in the apocalypse, the post-apocalypse, it's Universal Soldier and Sound of Music. And I think that The Postman was a really silly movie and it went on for way too long. But I will agree that I think it still had that element of watching a plausible world built from a lot of interesting specific details. And part of that is down to, I thought Kevin Costner was just a little too a little too much ego went into that movie. You know, there's a scene where he's in slow motion delivering the mail to one child. It's like, come on, give me a break. And the movie just kept going and going. I think they might have had a really good 90-minute movie in the middle of that three-hour movie. Yeah. So I'm not a fan, but I remember watching it and thinking, this isn't quite as bad as... I remember when it came out, it was like panned universally. And the same with Waterworld. And I'm kind of the same opinion. I actually think Waterworld's a better movie than The Postman. It's ridiculous. It has that same thing I talked about where you can look at this world and see the pieces it's built out of. I love the scene where he, at some point, he fashions some sort of oxygen bubble so they can breathe. And he takes her down to see that the city has sunk to the bottom of the ocean. And there's a scene where he goes fishing and he allows the fish to eat him before he harpoons it from the inside. Dennis Hopper is driving the Exxon Valdez that has giant oars that come out from its own an atoll and he just moves it along. Yep. Stuff like that's ridiculous. It's a stupid movie.
Right.
It's also too long.
Right.
But there were things I liked about both of those movies. I think Costner did at least grasp the idea of the heart of what makes an interesting post-apocalypse. But David Brin is the author who wrote The Postman. The Postman novel is a novel or a novella. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's much more interesting, I think, than the movie. But I think the heart of what's good about this kind of fiction is in those two movies.
Yeah.
I just don't know that they're all that successful.
Right. And I would definitely agree with that. You know, got to give a nod, too, because we did talk at length about this particular movie. But I still think it deserves to say that AI, artificial intelligence, you know, post-apocalyptic movie, you know, a flood has come in and... wiped out the world and because of
parts of the world. And I think that that's what's interesting is, and that's an interesting perspective because in AI, it never feels like an apocalypse because we still see people living in the suburbs. We still see people worrying about petty things like going to, you know, the flesh fairs where they go and they're destroying things and they still have time to worry about things like hate speech or things like, going to this like kind of extravagant, these robots attend to all their needs. These people haven't felt it, but clearly somebody somewhere has. And by the time the movie wraps up, we see that everybody's gone.
Right.
That 100% humanity is dead.
Yeah.
And that's grim.
Right.
But the film does begin with saying that the waters have piled up and that things are not good, you know. Right. It doesn't kind of make any bones about that, and the humans are still dying.
Right,
they're and that's just the still need caught up the in next. Their own. They're caught up in their own
lives,
their own lives, and their own kind of just silly conventions. You know, they're still stuck in all of their meaningless sort of the same sort of cycles they keep going through, and they're not really aware. And I think that's the thing. A lot of times, is a foreboding sense of post-apocalypse, but you don't feel that in AI until you get to the towards the, to end, the end of the movie.
No, and I completely agree. And again, if you know, you wanted to listen to a more comprehensive review on that, we did our Spielberg Fantastical World series, which we actually got an iTunes review, and somebody really complimented us on that one and really enjoyed that one.
Cool. So yeah. Well, thank you.
Check that.
Did that. I promise it wasn't me. Exactly. We put a lot of work in that. That was like a 4-episode sort of thing.
That was.
That I enjoyed doing that. That was fun. And AI is a great movie. I think an underrated movie, particularly in Spielberg's canon. So take a time. I was going through and mention some of these, Nathan. And we've seen them. We'll do the movies and I'm going to mention a few books.
Yeah.
A movie that I personally love that I don't know if we mentioned last time, but is very interesting in the sense that it is both apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic at the same time, which is 12 Monkeys.
Mm. I think we did mention that briefly, so this is a good time to explore that more fully.
So, have you seen 12 Monkeys?
I have not.
Oh, goodness. That's a movie I should... You should take that and watch it. You'll probably borrow it from me, return it 2 weeks and say you didn't watch it, but you should still take it.
So you can at least say...
Yeah. 12 Monkeys is, I think, is a really good movie. And it's actually... There was a movie... the movie I'm actually looking at here that I had written down was La Jetée, which is a movie by Chris Marker that was done much earlier and was actually done with all still frame photography.
Oh, okay.
But it was a short film about a time traveler from basically a blasted world who has come back to try to fix things. But he gets lost in time and in his own mind, and he can't quite make sense of things. And 12 Monkeys stars Brad Pitt, and Brad Pitt is in the sort of secondary role. The main role is Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis plays this traveler. Madeline Stowe is in the movie too. A good chunk of the movie takes place in Baltimore. Brad Pitt's character is in a mental asylum, and eventually that's where Bruce Willis ends up. He comes from the future, a world that is just completely annihilated by a virus. So we do know exactly what caused it. And the interesting thing where you're saying, hey, I'd like to know why this happened, without having any flashbacks, 12 Monkeys gets into that, because what happens is we see this world, it's barren, it's broken apart. It's almost in this weird sort of wintry sort of just slog. And Willis is going up to the surface. All of mankind is underground now. He's trying to gather signs of life to figure out if the virus has passed, if humanity could return to the top. And they've also found a way to start sending people back to find out how did this happen.
Okay.
So they're looking for enough clues. And when they send him back, he's essentially embroiled in everything that happens directly before the virus hits.
Gotcha.
And he's in the general area that they believe the virus has spread from. So he's running around trying to grab clues and trying to figure out in his own mind. He gets pulled back and forth so often that he's starting to not know which one's the real place. So he's starting to think that he's meeting with a psychiatrist in the present who's convincing him that the future people are just figments of his imagination.
Right.
And so he's trying to figure out, well, I can stay in whatever reality I want. I just have to train my brain. Even though he's not sure, and we're not sure, is he really being catapulted back and forth? And are the things he's doing in the present really shaping the army of the 12 monkeys that will cause this apocalypse? It's a really neat movie because it plays those two things together. You're watching the apocalypse and you're watching the preamble to the apocalypse happen at the same time.
Nice.
So I really enjoyed the movie. It's directed by Terry Gilliam. It's a little crazy. Probably a lot of people have seen it. It's definitely one of the better time travel movies that are on a mainstream level, I feel like. In Terminator 2, whenever you hit a paradox, you just had Arnold blow something up.
Right.
You can sort of forget about it. I guess in a sense, Terminators are also post-apocalyptic.
Right, yes.
Mixed with almost that 80s slasher kind of feel, the first movie. And then the second movie is just 80s big blockbuster action movie. And so the apocalypse recedes in most of those movies. Except, I guess, for Terminator Salvation.
Yeah, and then they just did Genesis, right?
Yeah, we shouldn't talk about that. that was a pretty awful movie. That was a terrible
Salvation
movie.
Actually takes place in the future with the idea that it wasn't stopped, correct?
Yeah, there's always this idea that it won't be stopped, and the fourth movie goes so far into that kind of nihilism that it almost undoes everything. Have you seen it?
No,
they're not very good. I mean, I enjoy Terminator. I enjoy Terminator 2. The further you get out from that, the less interesting these movies are. I think I enjoyed some things about Terminator 3. Terminator Salvation, to me, was a slog. Did I just you ever, couldn't get into it.
Since we're on Terminator, don't want to belabor it too long, but did you ever see the TV series?
The Sarah Connor Chronicles. Yes. I thought that was preferable to the last three films.
Okay.
Did you watch it?
I started watching. I think I saw the first two or three episodes. It's only like, what, one or two seasons?
It's only like two seasons. Yeah. It wasn't great. I liked the first season. I believe had maybe been given a little more time, it could have done something interesting. Mm-hmm. It did try to build in character dimensions. Lena Headey was in that. That was prior to Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And she was good in it. I think she did a very good Sarah Connor. She was more convincing as Sarah Connor than most of the actresses have followed it up.
Sure.
And I think that it could have been something. It just didn't get quite the chance. But to be fair, it ran two seasons. It still hadn't quite hit its stride. So two seasons, you know.
It's time to
put
up or shut up.
Exactly right.
Very cool. So I want to bring this up because I saw this movie in theaters. I am not saying it's a great movie, but I enjoyed it.
That seems to be your tagline.
It is. It is. It's funny because I do enjoy a lot of things because I think visually, and now let me put this out there, it's been years since I've seen it. Like I said, I saw it in theaters, have not seen it since. Rain of Fire.
But the dragons. Okay. So that is a legitimately, I think it falls outside of everything we're talking about in the term post-apocalyptic because it was a post-apocalypse due to dragons.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, what a phenomenally stupid movie that is. Although, I enjoy it as a B movie. It's a fun B movie.
It is. But come on, you got to give it props. Matthew McConaughey just leaps into the dragon's mouth. I mean,
well, you just ruined it.
Well, at this point.
Fair enough.
At this point. Yeah. I mean, it's been, what,
you know, I think originally Arnold Schwarzenegger was supposed to be on tap to be that
really?
Guy. Yeah, it didn't happen. And that was one of Christian Bale's early, like Christian Bale and Gerard Butler both in that movie.
Yes. Yep.
So I'm flipping through here in some movies because, with these things, I always want to mention some that people may not have seen. And I think a lot of people have potentially seen 12 Monkeys.
Yes. Yep.
So there are a lot of really weird ones out there. And there's a lot of movies that are just, kind of for lack of a better term, ridiculous. You know, it's better almost not even to mention them. But, I think, didn't a few years ago Vin Diesel have a movie like Babylon AD or something that was like a post-apocalyptic? Yeah. That was junk. There's 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later that I think we briefly touched on the deal with the zombies. But they are certainly post-apocalyptic in the way that they deal with it, particularly 28 Weeks Later because you're seeing a further length of time out.
Sure.
I enjoy both of those movies, but I don't think either one of them is great.
Yeah.
here's one for you, Tank Girl. Do you remember Tank Girl?
Yes.
With Lori Petty? Oh. There's a soft spot in my heart for Tank Girl. It's ridiculous. I think there's a water shortage that causes that in that film. And I think Ice-T plays a humanoid kangaroo. I'm pretty certain that he does. Nice. Naomi Watts is in that movie, too. Tank Girl,
that's right.
I kind of want to rewatch it just to see if it lives up to its awesome stupidness. Around the same time, maybe a few years later, there's a movie that I can almost guarantee you no one has seen called Six String Samurai. So this is one that I found when I was in college, probably like 2003, 2004, and I just loved it for its weird shabbiness. It's such a low-budget movie, but they made a little bit of money go a long way. And it essentially is taking that lone wolf and cub idea from Japanese films where you have this sort of samurai that befriends a young waifish child and wanders through this usually like a very devastated, very dangerous land where villains come out all over the place. It's a post-apocalypse here, and it's done with a kind of rockabilly slant. So after the war, the nuclear war, Elvis moves, it happens like in the 1950s, Elvis moves to Las Vegas, turns it into Lost Vegas, becomes the king of everything. And then about 50 years down the line, Elvis dies, and now all the rockers are on their way to Las Vegas to earn the new title of who's the new king. And so what's interesting is a lot of these characters are made up of, you have this deranged group that are like the Beatles who attack the main character who looks like Buddy Holly.
Nice.
And his name is Buddy, and he has a samurai sword and a guitar, and he wanders through the wasteland in a seersucker suit, basically, with big black glasses, and he fights the entire Russian army at one point, and Death, that looks like Slash from Guns N' Roses, is chasing him across the wasteland. And what's really neat is, like, you can see the shoddy special effects, but they have they've covered it up in such a way that it just doesn't matter. It's such a weird cult movie. And he's got the little kid with him, and at one point they're attacked by a monster. It looks like it's made out of a vacuum cleaner. Death's hat, which is a big, tall top hat kind of deal, much like Slash's. I'm pretty sure it's made out of construction paper. Most of the time it doesn't look like that. And they fight cannibals. They go all across the wasteland. Again, they encounter the Russian army. And it just sort of keeps going. And it even gets a little poignant along the way because, of course, Buddy has to eventually fight Death for the soul of the young child. And it's a weird movie. It's very weird. But I'd recommend it. If you wanna seek it out and you enjoy the kind of like B movie, like an extreme B movie, this is an extreme. In fact, it may not be a B movie. But the work that went into it is greater than the lack of budget that they had. So I'd say Six String Samurai. It's interesting too, because as you're watching the kind of fun thing, he's attacked by evil bowlers that attack him with bowling pins right in the beginning of the movie. He even fights cavemen. That's awesome. It is. It's a lot of fun. It'd be a great double feature with like Bubba Hotep or something like that. So it's on that sort of that kind of feeling. You remember all the like Christian apocalypse movies? It was like the Omega Code and Megiddo.
Yes.
Megiddo was fun because it just went so over the top. Like Arlie Ermey was like the president of the United States, which doesn't seem so far-fetched now. And I think he had a line like, the Lord giveth, and he cocked his gun, and the Lord taketh away. Yeah, that was a masterpiece. The Matrix is a post-apocalyptic story,
yes,
if you really think about it. Yep. I mean, that really came to light in the later movies, but we were so focused on how bad they were, we probably weren't paying attention to that as much.
Just watch the first one and take it as a standalone movie.
It's probably the best thing to do. There's a really cool French movie called Delicatessen that is essentially about the apocalypse has happened. We're not really sure what happened. In fact, this is no details whatsoever. We see everything ransacked and grubby and grimy, and there are people living under the ground. We keep hearing about troglodytes, and we're pretty certain that the troglodytes are bad. But eventually, and this isn't that far into the story, you learn that this weird hotel where everyone's staying, they're carving people up for meat. The troglodytes are the vegetarians that live down in the down below that are trying to stop this from happening. Right. So it's a weird sort of spin on H.G. Wells' A Time Machine, but it's just a strange, bizarre movie. Delicatessen is directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who did the fourth Alien movie, and also Amelie is maybe a movie that people know him for.
Yep.
He did Very Long Engagement, and he's done some other movies. This movie and a follow-up movie, which is also post-apocalyptic, but in a fairy tale way, stars Ron Perlman. It's called The City of Lost Children. And The City of Lost Children is like a really neat, very cool movie that if you are into like Tim Burton or into Terry Gilliam and you've not seen this movie, it's very steampunk. Very steampunk, but also sort of apocalyptic. And it's a really neat, I would highly recommend City of Lost Children.
Yep.
So many movies.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are, you know, as we're, I want to hear of some books from you in just a second. But, you know, as we're talking about these, you know, again, like really the kind of way we're framing these post-apocalyptic movies is something catastrophic has happened. And this is society after this event. And so, you know, for people who are out there and they're like, oh, well, that's technically not post-apocalyptic, blah, 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 because of X, Y. So what we're saying is this event has happened and it has caused, you know, a huge rift in the world in some sort because of what took place, whether it's nuclear, whether it's flood, whether it's aliens, whether it's, you know, fire, whatever it might
be. Hey, well, let's see, because we're familiar, we're mostly familiar with The Happening. Unfortunately, I think most
modern audiences. We are familiar
but
with
The Day of the Triffids, which is a classic John Wyndham story, has been made a couple times, and that deals with a meteorite that comes down, and when it hits Earth, it does two things. Blinds people and causes the plants to become kind of sentient and evil. I don't know, evil's maybe not the right word, but they are hostile, and they are kind of attacking. It's an alien vegetation, but people are blind at the same time. And it's a pretty compelling, it's that mix of apocalypse and post-apocalyptic, because there's a clear, this event has happened, and we're watching people kind of, we're watching the world fall down the line based on what's happened.
Yeah.
One of the best versions is probably the old 50s version, though there was a really creepy TV version done, I think, in the 70s that was good. One of the weirdest, I think, there's a couple. There's The Boy and His Dog with Don Johnson. that is a very strange... He and his telepathic dog are wandering across the wasteland. It's another weird midnight kind of movie. It's very darkly satirical.
Was that done in the vein of like K-9 and Turner and Hooch back in the
day?
No.
It was earlier than that. It was done. It was in the... It was following the same tide that led to Mad Max, but gotcha. I think it might have been earlier. An actor slash director, L.Q. Jones, was the guy who did that. And if you've ever seen... Did you see the... I don't think of movies you would have seen him in. Have you seen the Zorro movies? The ones with Antonio Banderas?
Yes.
The original Zorro movie, at the beginning of the movie, Antonio Banderas and his brother are traveling around with this kind of like... loudish sort of like convict guy. That guy, that's L.Q. Jones.
Okay, nice.
So the gravelly voice guy who I think at one point says, this is the second time I shot that man while flying through the air today. He directed the film. So this movie that came out in the 70s was directed by Richard Lester, and it was called The Bedsitting Room. Ralph Richardson was in it, and Ralph Richardson, when the apocalypse happens, Ralph Richardson literally starts turning into a bedsitting room, like an actual room. And you're kind of watching this happen to him. And it is such a weird, surreal movie. And, you know, it's one of the few movies I've seen where eventually most of the characters move into the main character.
Gotcha.
I like it. Because now he's just a room. I mean, it's ridiculous. I don't remember all the details. I just remembered that particularly. And seeing this and being like, huh?
What am I watching?
Exactly. What's happening? What is happening? But The Bedsitting Room. I don't know that it's a recommendation. We've talked about H.G. Wells a lot.
Yep.
He wrote a short story called Shape of Things to Come that was made into an interesting movie called Things to Come that dealt with... It's funny. It starts at Christmas in like 1940 and they're really concerned. They don't think enjoys because the war is about to start. Or they're concerned about a war beginning, and a war does begin and break out. And it kind of goes all the way to the 70s, and we see this whole apocalyptic world form. By 1970, you've got like a despotic ruler that rules everything, and everything's fallen into anarchy. And you're like, wow, usually 20 years you just you ran this down. And The Shape of Things to Come is very interesting. It's not a great movie, but it's an interesting one because, again, when it's originally made, it's going to a far-flung future.
Yeah.
But that far-flung future is now well in our past.
Yeah.
So it's old enough.
Right.
That, it was there in the early, like, 30s, I think.
Another one that I'm thinking of, this kind of almost takes a twist because it's almost an alternate reality movie, but I think you could put it in that classification. V for Vendetta
is a movie that's very interesting because it's more a dystopia in some ways than it is post-apocalyptic. However, I think, you know, it's definitely very dark, and there is a sense of how are we going to come back from this, but there is still a sense of hope. I don't know, I think that people would probably tend to place that more dystopic. But I don't know that makes it any less anxiety-provoking.
Right.
Maybe because the world of E for Vendetta feels like it has more real-world echoes, you know, in a sense of it doesn't require an apocalyptic can't-go-back-from-it trigger.
Sure.
It's a series of small events that lead up to getting to this world that is just ruled by...
Right.
Not even... I mean, people here think that they understand, you know, what fascism is, but you've never been in a country where fascism is really the ruling order of the day. And the world of V for Vendetta tries to imagine what that would be like if some of the countries we consider now to be democratic were to have split. And become sort of totalitarian.
Yeah. I think, you know, for me... You know, just kind of thinking through all of these, maybe looking at, and, you know, take a few more minutes and then we're going to wrap up here, but Planet of the Apes.
It's one I was waiting to see not, who was, which one was going to mention. I had it on. I was like, cannot move forward without Planet of the Apes.
Yep. So Planet of the Apes, you know, I remember seeing that one growing up and not fully understanding what was going on with that movie. And I think that was a little bit of... what frustrated me with that movie growing up, and then them going back and, you know, doing Rise of the Planet of the Apes and those two prequel movies, I had a better appreciation for, okay, this is what happened to bring this about, and this is how we got from there to there.
Let me ask you, Nathan, did you ever see the older Planet of the Apes movies?
What I'm referring to.
Oh, you're referring
to... Yeah, I'm not referring to the Mark Wahlberg...
Oh, you said Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
And I'm talking the original series. So there was Planet of the Apes with Charlton Heston. Then there was Beneath the Planet of the Apes and Escape. Did you see all those?
Oh, yeah.
So they did, in a sense, explain how the world came about, but sort of in a weird... at some point, time travel occurs, and then you see that Cornelius and Zira have a son who is Caesar, who Caesar is a character that tags over in the two more recent ones. So the old series did sort of explain. And actually, to be fair, and I mean, again, spoilers for a movie that's how old now, about 60 years old, but the original Planet of the Apes wraps up with a pretty clear idea of what happened. You don't know everything, but you know enough with that final scene that's now considered iconic. We actually went and saw it over the summer at the Senator. I went with a group of people, and actually Phantom Galaxy, I think our first episode, if you want to hear this, you can go back to the Phantom Galaxy episode. You can also, it's on, I think, the Pop Culture Ninja Podbean. And we kind of delve into that original Planet of the Apes to a larger degree. But it was interesting to rewatch that movie and kind of see where they were coming from and see how a lot of the thoughts that were in that film are still thoughts that are still banned. Like, some of these elements we aren't that much further along on today. You know, the way the movie's still kind of questioning the faith versus science argument isn't really couch that differently today. Sure. You know, the parameters that still govern that argument, if you will, haven't really developed a whole lot since 1968. So,
yep, very cool. Well, man, this has been great.
Let's get a couple books.
Yeah, throw a couple books in there.
So I would recommend there's several really good books that would be considered post-apocalyptic fiction. The one that I'm going to, there's a couple. The first one I'd really put an emphasis on, because it's so different than what you're expecting from your usual post-apocalyptic story, and it's probably the kind of template in a way. The problem is now, I've mentioned this I think last time, is when we start reading some of these stories, they've had such a deep influence on everything that went before them that when we read them, there's a tendency to be like, oh, I know this. Oh, this is kind of blasé.
Right.
But A Canticle for Leibowitz, which is an excellent, Walter M. Miller Jr., this book is fantastic. It is the precursor for most post-apocalyptic fiction. It doesn't really feel like a post-apocalyptic story in a sense that you're usually used to, because there's not a lot of great battle or struggle going on in a certain sense.
Sure.
But it takes place, you're talking like 600 years after an event. So they call it the Flame Deluge. And it's, again, mankind did it to themselves. We know that much. And you have these few survivors, and the world that these characters live in is just one that's going back into superstition and fear, and the world that people used to know has become almost a myth.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see people struggling with the same things we struggle in now that's caused the world to fall, and you see this central character and the way the story plays out. I don't want to say too much about it because, again, being a kind of like almost proto-template for a lot of the stories that came after, it's best just to discover it. It has a very textured sense to it. It's not just, you don't really read this one just for the plot.
Yeah.
I think it's going to surprise a lot of people because you'll probably come to it and say, I kind of know this. I'm used to this sort of story.
Sure.
But really good. And then Kurt Vonnegut wrote some very interesting stories. He did The Cat's Cradle, which is just a really kind of out there storyline that deals with technology and the way in which our technology will eventually kind of overcome our humanity and be our downfall. And of course, that's, I think, one of the fears that everyone worries about is that idea of the apocalypse at the hands of AI, you know, to like things like Vonnegut doesn't quite go into the AI angle, but those stories, another Harlan Ellison, who had written some of the works that came to inspire the Terminator, has done several short stories and stories that deal with the apocalypse.
Yep.
And Damnation Alley, Roger Zelazny did a book called Damnation Alley that they made into a movie, a kind of weird, cheesy 70s movie that is one of those kind of Southern California's just turned into another wasteland like Mad Max.
Yep.
I remember the movie had giant scorpions. The book is a little bit more... The book is very gritty, very sort of hard-hitting, if you're, that's the kind of story you're looking for. I'm trying to think of newer books. There's a book recently I read, and I think it... I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. Excellent choice, because that's sort of the template for everything from Night of the Living Dead to the very various versions we had of I Am Legend, and a Vincent Price movie called The Last Man on Earth. and I think Charlton Heston's a Mega Man. Mm-hmm. All of those stories, they have their genesis in I Am Legend.
Very cool.
So those, I mean, there's a whole list. I think it would be, if I get a chance, I will, on our Facebook page, I will throw up a list of books, and then I'll try to get Goodreads has not been as successful on the Goodreads front. We'll have to try and reclaim that whole project. But we'll try to get a list up, because I think there's some really good fiction out there. There's some that's not so good. It's hard to sit there and talk about all of it, but you could spend an entire podcast on books alone, and the styles in which people write to kind of create those worlds. And I think that's what I find interesting. Can you give me something that's plausible, that feels like it stems from a collapse, and that the rebuilding is plausibly human?
And I agree. Like, there, it's hard for me because I enjoy entertainment. And Nathan, you've hung out with me enough to know that I appreciate high quality entertainment, and I appreciate not so high quality entertainment.
I'm taking the first one. Hear your word. I'm just kidding.
That's awesome. But, you know, one of the things, and like I said, you know, when I look at those post-apocalyptics, I want to know the whys. And so, you know, as you said, I'm more into that apocalyptic, you know, oh, here's what's going on. Let's dig in and figure out a solution to stop this sucker from happening. You know, once it's already done and happened, it's kind of like,
how will you ever prove your survival skills, though, without the post-apocalypse?
No, my survival skills are coming in the apocalyptic, not the post-apocalyptic.
I figured a way not to get killed.
That's right. You know, so, but no, this has been fun, and I love these little, you know, mini series that we do, you know, with these things, and I think our listeners appreciate them too. So.
Yeah, that's other worlds. I think it'll be interesting to move on to some things that hopefully are a little lighter. I mean, we've done dystopias, and we've done post-apocalypse, apocalypse. We did utopias. That was, you know, I don't know, we had much to say because they were so positive.
Right.
But I think it'd be interesting to look at maybe now other worlds that fall into the lens of things like fantasy realms, you know, fairy worlds and realms of mythology and stuff like that.
And we will be talking about legend in that one.
Legend. Love the Ridley Scott legend.
Absolutely. All right. So we're going to go ahead and sign off. We'll catch you all later.
Take care.